You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
Welcome to Sustainable Futures. On today's episode, we are going to have a local story and an international story. The local story will be as local as it gets for us here on Sustainable Futures. It is an initiative from Sustainable SFU. We are based out of Simon Fraser University's CJSF 90.1 FM, and the university here has a teach-in initiative.
We know that the province has introduced a Bill 44, which is dated for 2010, and it says that all campuses need to be carbon neutral by 2010, otherwise there's a big fee to pay.
And in the second half of the show, we'll be having an interview with Rodman Hodes of Transparency International, an organization dedicated to the abolition of corruption.
Some of our founding members had worked in the World Bank, and it was that experience of development gone wrong that profoundly influenced them to take up the anti-corruption cause.
So these are founding members.
Many of the international institutions are working more and more in the fight against corruption, and we're glad to have them as allies. That isn't to say that we think they always get everything right.
It will be a very good show today. Welcome to Sustainable Futures. Welcome to Sustainable Futures. I'm your host, Ryan Fletcher. The first interview today is brought to us by Frida Worden, who is a very talented and experienced interviewer in the campus community radio scene, the host of the internationally acclaimed WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service, and she's also our spoken word programmer here at CJSF. She was kind enough to do an interview for Sustainable Futures, and she's interviewing the group Sustainable SFU, Louise Kangian and Ashley Cullough, and they're talking about a few of their initiatives, primarily a teach-in initiative that is going to be spreading knowledge around this university about sustainable issues.
Welcome to Sustainable Futures. I'm Frida Worden, hosting an interview today with Ashley Cullough and Louise Kangian. Ashley Cullough and Louise Kangian are with Sustainable SFU. That's a club here at Simon Fraser University, and they are also interested in becoming a nonprofit organization, and we'll discuss that later in the interview. But right now, they're here to talk about a teach-in that they're planning. So let's ask Ashley to tell us something about the teach-in, like when, who, and why.
Well, the teach-in is actually a province-wide initiative, and so there's going to be campuses and students from all over BC taking part of it, and it's from March 2nd to the 6th. What the teach-in entails is 15 minutes at the beginning of the class the professors set aside to talk about climate change and how they can relate climate change to their classroom discussion and creating a sustainable dialogue between students and their professors.
So this is 15 minutes to talk on the topic of sustainability. So how are you suggesting that the teachers of the classes would introduce this?
we kind of give the professors a model of about 8 questions that they can pick which questions work within their course. And there's questions from as simple as, how does climate change affect your class, as to some more complex ones for maybe a social science or an environmental science class, such as how can we go to making a climate neutral campus.
Now, this issue of the climate neutral campus, where does this idea come from? Louise, would you like to say something about that?
Climate change has been a pressing issue for some time now. I think we've known for a few decades now that climate change has been an issue. Only recently have we seen it come back into our, you know, mainstream ideas. Carbon neutral view is the suggestion of a type of lifestyle where you have zero carbon emissions and a zero carbon footprint. We know that the province has introduced a Bill 44, which is dated for 2010, and it says that all campuses need to be carbon neutral by 2010, otherwise there's a big fee to pay.
Now, is this something that's been introduced or has it actually been passed?
Oh no, it's definitely been passed. The matter now that I believe is up for discussion is, what are they going to do with all those fees? So I believe the discussion is leading towards putting, like for example, if SFU has to pay $10 million in fees, it's probably going to go to a Pacific Carbon Trust fund. And the argument now is, okay, well, can we get some of that money back? Or what's going to happen with all that money in the trust fund? Is it going to go towards investment, towards sustainable initiatives on campus? That's where the discussion is. But we're definitely paying a large sum at the end of 2010 unless we're carbon neutral.
How could we become carbon neutral? What are some big things?
Well, I believe the bill outlines 3 major areas, and I suggest interested listeners double check, but it seems to focus on transportation, and that means, you know, staff coming to campus. And it also takes into consideration paper consumption and energy consumption on campus. So that's the 3 sort of areas that the government seems to be considering, and that's what it's using to calculate carbon neutrality on campus. So it's not really thinking about food and food miles and stuff like that, which true carbon neutrality would take into consideration, but this is their first step. Maybe that'll be something that's they're going to be considering in our next bill for carbon neutrality, maybe 2015 or something like that. I don't know.
So, Ashley, all right, say I'm a professor of criminology. How am I going to have this discussion with my class? What would you recommend?
Well, I think that the whole idea of this teaching is to bring how climate change affects all these different areas, even criminology. The idea, I think, is that you get your class talking about it and you get them thinking about these things. Maybe we need to, in our laws, create some climate taxes or some sort of thing.
Some jail time for people who have larger than, like, 5 whatever their carbon emissions, something like that. That would be something I could see coming out of a criminology class.
Wow. I have to admit that that when I've seen people driving Hummers, it always makes me wish that they could be jailed, so maybe there could be a law for that.
Yeah, definitely.
Especially when they're by themselves in the HOV lane. But, Ashley, what is your own discipline? How would it relate? If you were teaching in your own discipline for this teach-in, what would you bring up?
Well, I'm in international studies, so I think there's obvious, for example, the desert are getting larger because of this climate change, and it affects the people that are living close to these deserts because they're losing a lot of their land that they might have used otherwise for farming. So it really makes us look at how the fact that developed countries are the ones that are creating a lot the emissions of the carbon emissions. If I was to be a professor in my discipline, we could talk about how what we're doing is affecting other people and looking at it as a whole picture instead of it just being like a singular place.
Oh yeah, so maybe even like virtual water, anyhow, where you buy flowers from another country and that means you're importing water from that mm-hmm. country along with the flowers and so forth. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, Ashley. Sorry, Louise, you were going to say something here. Please do.
No, I was. If you could see me, I was nodding my head and disagreeing. That's definitely the big issue is people don't realize when you do buy flowers, you're also buying water, you're buying a lot of the energy that went into producing those flowers, you're buying a lot of stuff. So it's really important to have more conscious consumers, I think, and that's very much related to climate change as well as sustainability.
What's your field?
I'm a business econ joint major, so I think a lot of people I get some raised eyebrows when I say that, and then I say I'm involved with sustainability. But the Faculty of Business at SFU has been making efforts to be more and more, you know, sustainability conscious in their courses and their programs.
And that's exactly what the teaching is about, is getting things like business courses having a sustainable spin-off to them, and creating this new kind of idea of education and giving it more bulk, I think, and making people think outside of the box in a lot of these classes.
Especially with some of the business classes, I really hope that a lot of professors agree to do it, because right now in Faculty of Business, you see a trend where every class, at least at 300, 400 levels, have some sort of sustainability involved in them. So I get a lot of emails from students doing the project management course, 360 or 361, I believe. I haven't taken it yet myself. And they'll be like, oh, you know, our professors told us to do a project on sustainability, and we have to come up with a project on how to make SFU more sustainable. And I'll say, that's great, that's what we sort of want, but has a professor actually told you anything about sustainability? And they'll be like, well, no. And I'm like, well, what do you think sustainability is? And they'll be like, well, isn't it like planting trees and stuff? And I'll be like, at that point, I, you know, die a little inside. So the whole thing to teach and I'll bring to light to these professors that as much as they can put sustainability in the curriculum, unless there's more teaching about what it is, they'll know that their students really don't know that much about what sustainability really is. Maybe I'll make the Faculty of Business reevaluate their curriculum a little bit.
Well, if the students have to do a project on sustainability right now, and their professors haven't told them anything, where would you advise them to go to get the information?
There's lots of places, actually. Go Beyond is a good resource, where Ashley will know quite a bit. Actually, she's a good resource. SFU also has a sustainability page. It's www.sfu.ca/sustainability, and it has all the information about sustainability on campus. But there's also quite a few good books that everyone should read. There is Towards Sustainable Communities by our own celebrity, Dr. Mark Roseland. And what should be done from the very beginning is there should be a mandatory sustainability course for all business students. I believe UVic has that, and it makes the biggest difference on their students. So,
wow. So Go Beyond was just mentioned, and we mentioned it briefly at the very beginning, but Ashley, would you talk some more about Go Beyond, what it is?
Sure. Go Beyond got started last semester. It was a BC initiative. This semester, they had a couple of pilot universities last semester. I think there was three. And this semester, we have six, and I think we have two that are also kind of affiliated with us as well. The whole idea behind Go Beyond is getting people to go beyond their climate neutral. So some things that Go Beyond does is it does do this teaching. It does challenges, personal, residential, and group challenges, or home challenges. And a big thing that just actually got started up this week is a carbon footprint calculator, which is on their website. And you go on it and you calculate your carbon footprint, and then it gives you ideas on how you can change and how you can take a mission to just even from doing little things such as, you know, starting to compost or having herbs growing in your windowsill to as radical as not using any cars and walking and biking everywhere you go. It's really dynamic. It allows for students to have a huge resource from all over the province. It's a great way to take climate change in whatever way you want to take it and make it your own.
So Go Beyond is provincial in mm-hmm. BC.
Yeah.
And what is that website again?
It's go-beyond.ca. Yes, I'm pretty sure it's CA.
Or it's Go Beyond in your Google search bar, and it'll be the first website that comes up.
Well, that's one way to be sure of that. Yeah, and then maybe there's some other Go Beyonds you could find. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, definitely, it'll be the first one that comes up, and you'll know once the minute you click on it, because it's a beautiful website with a beautiful carbon calculator on the front page, which everyone should try out.
And it only takes about 10 minutes to do, and it's really quite interesting because some of the questions it always has the option I don't know, and so when you're going through it, it's like I don't know how I get my gas. I don't know if it's gas powered or if it's electrical. I don't know if I've got a high flow tap or like those kinds of questions that you then can go and question yourself about and think about till the next time you do your carbon footprint.
I can hardly wait to go to go go-beyond.ca or Googling Go Beyond and find out what my carbon footprint is and how I can improve it. That sounds like a great activity. You say professors can decide whether their teachers can decide whether they want to do this teach-in. And again, the dates were March...
The 2nd to the 6th.
March 2nd to 6th. They could choose to do that. Mm-hmm. But what about students wanting to put pressure on their instructors to bring it up? Where would they get a release about this that they could hand out to their teachers?
Well, we would actually love to have volunteers come and help us to talk to professors. They could get information if they email SFU at...
They can get information when they email sustain at sfu.ca.
Oh, okay,
I'll just forward it.
All right, so sustain at sfu.ca is an email, and that is for your group, which is called Sustainable SFU, coincidentally. Mm-hmm. Yes,
it's very fitting.
Yes. You say that Sustainable SFU is thinking about launching a nonprofit now. Tell me a little bit about that, please.
Forming a nonprofit with Sustainable SFU has been an idea that's been around since the very beginning. And now we're at a point where we're like, okay, it's about time. Sustainability on campus is getting really, you know, it's definitely gotten into the mainstream a lot more. There's a lot of eager students and groups that are interested in going forward with this. We just need a little bit more financial support. And we thought going nonprofit was the best thing we could have done to make sure that we do have some extra funding, especially once we're an established society. So we've started the application process, and hopefully by the end of the month we get our paperwork back and we'll be officially a nonprofit, and our accepted name is Simon Fraser Sustainability Association. What will happen is then Sustainable SFU will officially become a project of the Simon Fraser Sustainability Association. And with this nonprofit, we are planning on putting a referendum question on the next student elections in March, which is, I believe, March 17th, 18th, 19th. That's asking students for a little bit of funding. We haven't decided on the dollar value, but it'll be between $1 and $2, something around the same price as a cup of coffee, to go towards the SFSA, the Sustainability Association, so that we can continue to support student projects or continue to support some of these projects on campus that relate to sustainability. So it's been a lot of paperwork and a lot of meetings, but if all goes well, we'll have our funding starting in the summer, and we can really start, you know, spearheading and pushing forward some of these projects, like composting that's been around and talked about forever, and it's about time we actually push for it.
Oh, you mean the campus is not composting now?
No, it's not. Composting has been tried before and again, and facilities management has actually taken it to heart. They are very interested in pushing forward with composting. They have hit a couple of roadblocks, and we're at the point where we're like, okay, why don't we let students work with the administration, work with facilities management to help make composting possible. That's our next main goal, I think. With a little bit of funding, we can at least help out the students that are putting their time towards projects like this by giving them honorariums or stipends. That's sort of where we want most of the funding to go anyways, from the referendum money, and potentially hire maybe one part-time person to start doing some grant applications and taking care of the basic office work that needs to be in place to run a nonprofit.
Okay, so the students could do composting. Maybe the students could start doing snow removal by hand. I see that $1 million was spent on snow removals this season.
I heard that too. One project at a time. But I think, especially with composting, a big issue is education. So even if facilities if they were able to work out the financial end of things, they could get bins in place, they could figure out what to do with all the compost, whether they're going to sell it or take it off the mountain, they still need a lot of help with education. Like, people need to know how to use these compost bins. And that's where we've been telling the administration and faculty that this is where students would love to come and we'd love to be a part of this. Why don't you let us help you with the education campaign of things? It's free labor, actually, in the end of it, right? So that's sort of where we'll be like, okay, let us help you with this. And then that way we can see not only the SFU community get a little bit better, but see projects really push forward and without any extra funding, which seems to be a big issue right now.
Yes, that is really a big issue right now at the university. I mean, I was horrified to hear that if the university doesn't become carbon neutral, it will have to pay more out of its already apparently insufficient funding. I think that should be a pretty big incentive.
It's a very scary thought, and I think it does keep some of the university admin up at night, but it's coming and it's scary, and they're definitely going to have to pay if we don't do something about our carbon footprint.
Wow. Okay, so teach-in, March 2nd to 6th, you say?
Yep, the whole week.
The whole week, and all the classes are urged to discuss how to be carbon neutral and sustainable in their courses, no matter what the subject. And the folks who are here today with us, Ashley Kola and Louise Kanjian, they are from Sustainable SFU, and the teach-in is jointly with other schools around the province under the umbrella of Go Beyond. Just Google Go Beyond, and you'll find a beautiful website that you can also use to check your carbon footprint. Anything else you'd like to say, folks?
If anyone's interested in volunteering, either to help out with the referendum, the Go Beyond, composting, or any other sustainability-related projects on campus, you could email us at sustain@sfu.ca, and we'll be really, really looking forward to working with you. So thank you very much for your interest.
Thank you for your time.
And the next interview on Sustainable Futures will be with Robin Hodes, who's part of a really interesting international organization called Transparency International. You can just see right through it. And what it's about is the fight against corruption, and it just takes corruption head on. You can go after corrupt governments, or you could go after corruption itself. And that's what Transparency International is geared to do. So it was a very interesting interview opportunity that I came across. So this is Ryan Fletcher with Sustainable Futures, and I'm interviewing Robin Hodes of Transparency International. Thank you for joining us today on Sustainable Futures.
Thanks for inviting us.
And first of all, let's introduce our audience. What is Transparency International?
Transparency International is a global civil society organization. That means we work around the world, independent civil society groups or non-governmental groups, that's a term that maybe more people are familiar with, in about 100 countries. We have a headquarters in Berlin, Germany. And from Berlin, we coordinate the work of the chapters of our organization around the world. So we're fighting globally against corruption and fighting for transparency and accountability in both the public and private sector. Mm-hmm. But we're working locally in these 100 countries via the national chapters. And again, as I said, we're nonprofit and non-governmental.
Okay, so how does that work? How are you able to work both globally and locally?
Well, that's obviously a line that a lot of organizations try to straddle, but we think we do it in a unique way, because when we were set up about 15 years ago. We were set up by a lot of senior former public officials, people who'd worked in international development issues around the world, and they'd seen the damage that corruption had done, and they brought with them their global experience and global context. And they got together and raised alarm bells about the way corruption was destroying societies and preventing good economic development. But then they decided they would set up a unique structure to allow national chapters of this new group to develop on their own, so that they could take these lessons and make them applicable to how politics worked in a particular country, to the special setting that takes place in every country, the institutions, the way the economy works, and so on. So it's this global and clear message that corruption hurts people, but taken down into countries and into the specifics of what the challenges are that each country faces. Because after all, no country is free of corruption, but corruption works at different levels.
Yeah, it's really interesting. When I first came across this organization, that I thought it was kind of brilliant and innovative to go directly at corruption itself rather than a single institution that is corrupt. I really like that. Was that sort of the idea, is just trying to get to the root of corruption?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge with corruption is you can't fix one thing, because it's a system. First of all, there's two sides to any corruption equation. There are those who demand the bribes and want bribes in order to sometimes do work they're supposed to do, sometimes to skim off the top and make profits for themselves, sometimes just to get a power base. And then there are those who pay the bribes. Those are often, you know, the companies, whether they're multinationals working abroad or just companies working in their own country, who think, you know, they're going to get the deal by paying this money. And sometimes it's a very sinister system that's in place.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way that we think it's possible to really fix that is to work on all the institutions that provide checks and balances. So you can't just cherry pick out various aspects of the system and say if you fix that, everything else will follow. It's really important that all institutions have integrity checks and balances, that there's some sort of oversight to how systems work. And by that, I don't just mean public sector institutions. I also very much mean the private sector, because business has to step up to the plate. Mm-hmm. They have to say how they're fighting corruption inside the mm-hmm. company, what kind of training they do for their employees, and so on. So it's really a burden on all sides to lift the bar and to create an integrity system that works for everyone and reduces corruption overall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there a set system that you take to any organization to deal with corruption? Like, is there sort of set guidelines that Transparency International has set in place, or is it mm-hmm. a case-by-case sort of thing?
Well, for the private sector, as I just mentioned, we do have a set of standards that we've developed. They're called the Business Principles for Countering Bribery. And we really go through what a firm needs to have in place to make sure that anti-corruption can flourish instead of corruption. So these include things like disclosing information about how they're fighting corruption, making sure, as I said, that there's training, that there's clear company policies not to allow bribery or even small facilitation payments that sometimes allow a deal to get through. But importantly as well, there has to be protection of whistleblowers, because after all, sometimes it's these very courageous people who speak out and show where the problems are, and they have to be protected. Mm-hmm. There has to be a system in place for that. For the public sector, of course, there's all different levels. You could be talking about looking at the customs office, or you could be talking about looking at how procurement is done across the system. So it's very important that for both the public and the private sector, the messages we have are tailored, but we try to do diagnostics and then come up with what applies, particularly in a country.
Mm-hmm. Do you work directly with the organizations or with people involved in the organizations that are concerned about the corruption? Because I just can't imagine how you could go to an organization and just say, you're corrupt and we're going to help you.
No, I mean, if anything, we try to look at corruption risks. We're not an organization that works on the basis of investigations. We're obviously very supportive of investigative journalism, and we believe strongly in free access to information and the availability of information so that the news media can play a strong role to mm-hmm. protect citizen interests and so on. But really what we try to do is work together with institutions, both public and private sector, to say, this is the way forward. Here you have risks, and here you can bring in more checks and balances to make sure you're working to combat the risks. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when there are cases of corruption, they have to be followed. They have to be prosecuted. And there can't be impunity for corruption. Otherwise, this is a very negative signal to society and other institutions that some people are allowed to get away with it. So it's very important that that aspect of the corruption problem is addressed as well.
Okay, so now I'd like to move the conversation to sustainability. What is it about corruption that makes a system unsustainable?
The empirical evidence that's out there shows that both at a small level of paying small bribes, but also at those big deal clinchers that sometimes, you know, run into the millions and millions, corruption really undermines the way the private market works. So there's no evidence that just a little bit corruption is okay because it allows growth and so on. Sometimes people say, you know, economies can soar for a while as long as the trade is working and everybody benefits a little. But ultimately, corruption skews the way the market works. It doesn't create a level playing field. So what you're doing in the long run is you're bringing costs onto future generations. You're allowing there to become, you know, multi-tiered systems of how healthcare works, how education works. People have to pay for what should be free services. So really what you're building is a system that's unsustainable because it doesn't help everyone and it doesn't give everyone a chance. So corruption is about equity. Or fighting corruption is about building greater equity in a society mm-hmm. and not having that equity and not having the capacity for sustainable growth ultimately hurts people.
All right. So it really comes down to developing a system of equity, equality type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. And why do you think corruption is so common?
Well, it's difficult. Corruption takes place when there aren't strong institutions, when there aren't traditions of openness in a society. Sometimes corruption can be caused by very difficult circumstances in a country, such as endemic poverty or natural disaster. But likewise, corruption can cause poverty. So things can work in two directions, but you generally see countries that face major obstacles like civil war, chronic natural disaster, and so on, are often looking at difficult situations where institutions have a tough time dealing with basic needs of people. There are lots of countries in the world that have great natural resource wealth, but don't share the benefits of that wealth with their own population. Rather, there are companies, often foreign companies, that come in, take the natural resources and bring them into the international market, mm-hmm. bypassing the needs of the local people. Mm-hmm. And in those circumstances, there isn't enough money that's put into development, put into institutions, put into the kinds of processes that we benefit from in Europe and North America to a right. great extent.
And that's a very important point, because corruption is very much a global activity now. Would you be able to speak on that a little bit? I mean, I think of big organizations like the World Bank and things like that. Does Transparency International work on that level?
Yes, of course we do. I mean, some of our founding members had worked in the World Bank, and it was that experience of development gone wrong that
yeah.
profoundly influenced them to take up the anti-corruption cause.
So these are founding members.
Many of the international institutions are working more and more in the fight against corruption, and we're glad to have them as allies. That isn't to say that we think they always get everything right.
Yeah.
It's very important that they, too, safeguard how they work on development, that they coordinate, that they put the kinds of checks and balances and openness into their own investment in developing countries. But of course, when I mentioned before why corruption is so prevalent, I was talking about where corruption is really endemic, where you really see poor countries suffering and not being able to lift themselves out of this kind of curse and circularity, if you will, of corruption and poverty. But there's plenty of corruption in wealthy countries as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's just at a different level. It's often well hidden by accountants and lawyers and others who make the system work to protect the interests of some of the wealthiest in society. And, of course, we have a universal problem that's shared both North and South, rich and poor, and that's
mm-hmm.
political corruption. There's
yeah.
a grave concern about the way politics plays a role that isn't what it's meant to be, and obviously when there's suspicion of corruption, it really undermines belief in the political process and the capacity of elections to serve the interests of citizens.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious as to how well known your organization is over here in North America. I guess I should let the audience know that I'm speaking to you in Germany. I actually haven't heard of Transparency International until I just read about it a few days ago. Is this more of a household name in Europe? Or
we sometimes benefit from the fact that where corruption is known day in and day out as a problem, sometimes our chapter's been able to raise awareness of the issue of corruption and also of our work. That's not to say there aren't profound challenges in North America, but a lot of the work that we're doing does concentrate on working together with the business sector. We're not always the NGO that's the loudest in the crew of NGOs. We like
mm-hmm.
to work together with different, we'd say, stakeholders or partners in the fight against corruption, because we really think building a constructive alliance with public institutions, private institutions, is, again, a sustainable approach to fighting corruption, giving opportunity for real long-term change. So
mm-hmm.
I'd say in some countries we're very well known, and obviously it's a challenge to us to try to make ourselves better known, no matter the size of our representation, large or small, around the world.
Mm-hmm.
We do have one instrument that's very well known. We publish an annual index called the Corruption Perceptions Index.
Oh, neat.
That provides a rank of the perceived levels of corruption in the public sector in about 180 countries around the world. And for that, we get quite a lot of attention and press coverage. But we do a lot of other surveys and diagnostics, and we're constantly trying to round out and fill in the picture of what we know about corruption and transparency.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point, the perceived level of corruption, because I think that probably has a lot to do with the health of a society. Because, I mean, corruption, one thing that it probably would do is breed mistrust, right?
Yes, there's a strong empirical link between levels of corruption and levels of trust, not only in institutions, but trust between people in a society. So corruption can really erode the fabric of a society.
You are listening to Sustainable Futures. This is an interview with Robin Hodes of Transparency International. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious as to what your idea of maybe more of opinion or something of what a more sustainable form of society could be.
The countries that do the best in a lot of our diagnostics are those that have the most open systems.
Mm-hmm.
So by that, what do I mean? I mean the systems where politicians often have to declare their assets publicly so that there can be fewer or fewest possible conflicts of interest between their political work and their private interests. There are societies where the media is very robust, where news media are not prosecuted, where journalists are not routinely shot for covering hard-hitting issues, where the public can get access to information about the public budget, about what government raises and spends in terms of taxes and then spending on public sector issues, so that they can trace what happens to their money and how it's spent and make politicians feel they're held to account for the decisions they take with the public purse. And those kinds of elements contribute to societies and systems that are more transparent, have less corruption, and therefore, I would say, are also part of this sustainability equation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's interesting that you're talking about the media having a big role. I can definitely see the connection there. Maybe you could elaborate a little bit for our audience how media can really help or hinder the process of corruption.
We all know about corruption because we hear about big cases in the news media.
Yes.
I mean, to some extent, of course, that can be a sign or an indication to the public, gee, there must be even more corruption. But actually, we think it's a healthy thing if there's a lot of news on corruption. That means that journalism is working,
mm-hmm.
that there's a free press, an independent press, that say, for example, issues about media ownership, how, you know, newspapers and other news outlets are owned, don't conflict with what journalists feel they can investigate and look into so that they aren't quieted down for the sake of private interest. If journalists weren't courageous enough to pursue cases and try to get the facts, we wouldn't know about a lot of the corruption that's out there. But the fact that a lot of corruption is covered, of course, has a double-edged sword. As I said, you could begin to think there's more corruption now than ever before, but I think what we're seeing is that the taboo is disappearing, that people are ready to really explore how this works, what's behind it, why this form of interaction isn't good, and it's time to really crack down on it and not just not look at it as business as usual and that this is how systems work and we have to accept it because it's so distorting that it's all the more important that we fight it.
Mm-hmm. There is that interesting phenomenon when the media starts reporting on something, people think that it's just starting to happen. But what it usually means is that the media just hasn't been doing a good job in the past.
We feel very supportive of the function that media has in terms of adding a loud voice to spreading knowledge and spreading awareness of how systems work, of corrupt deals, and so on. And because our own philosophy as an organization is not to look into cases, but to try to take broader, long-term view on what cases mean for building stronger systems, then we feel a very strong position of solidarity for the role media has and feel that it really does need to be supported. I mean, there's no question that traditional media are under threat by things like the current financial crisis, and mm-hmm. one needs to make sure that the space is retained for the independent voice of media to do its work, do its investigative work, to provide that extra check and balance on other strong elements in society, like government and like the private sector.
Mm-hmm. I guess a local example I can bring to our audience is the Olympics coming here in Vancouver. I was recently at a meeting with all the public media to talk about how to cover the Olympics, because the corporate media is going to be definitely very much involved in a lot, and really it does a lot of what is talked about is under the subject of corruption, and I can definitely see where there's a nice union between transparency and the media, particularly public media in most cases, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the Olympics always brings up a lot of issues. Football, soccer is one of the most popular sports in the whole world, and every year there are thousands of scandals about bribes and match fixing. And this is obviously a concern that can really bring, you know, the issue of corruption, you know, to everyone's level, because sport is a very important part of a lot of people's lives, and to see it be abused and manipulated might not be the same as denying medicines to poor people, but it's a crucial issue as well in terms of the amount of money that's involved in the sporting industry. And at the same time, there's also the issue of how buildings are built for Olympics and so on, and this whole public works process around supporting the infrastructure of the Olympics. We were very involved as an organization in supporting transparency before the Beijing Olympics and making sure that there was the strongest possible openness about how the infrastructure for the Olympics came about.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the origins of transparency. Maybe give us a little brief history of how this organization came about.
About 15 years ago, at a moment in time when the Cold War had ended and the very broad camps of the free world and the communist world had been broken down, the issue of transparency and the fight against corruption sort of emerged as a relevant issue. Until then, a lot of discussion about corruption had to be hushed under this kind of bipolar framework, because countries, say, in the developing world, were either allied with the West or with the former Soviet Union, then the Soviet Union. So there was a lot of tension that was pushed under regarding the corruption issue, and it wasn't dealt with directly because of these political alliances. When the system changed and communism fell, there was a space, a political space, for addressing these issues head on, because it was very clear then that nobody was going to thrive and develop with corruption. And now that it wasn't underneath those other issues, it could be addressed. And there were a group of people who, via their experience, their professional life, had been exposed to the role of corruption on the ground in countries around the world. Many of them had worked in Africa and Latin America. And they were at the point of retiring or moving on or career changing. They had accumulated lots of experience and a lot of contacts, and they knew senior people in politics and in business. And they banded together around this then crazy idea of starting a non-governmental organization to fight corruption. And the organization was set up in Berlin 15 years ago. The founder, Peter Eigen, was originally from Berlin, or his wife's family was from Berlin, and he had his career at the World Bank and took early retirement to start this project with his fellow travelers. And, you know, we're the beneficiaries of their vision. 15 years later, we are about 100 people at the International Secretariat. I think we're from about 30 different countries at the International Secretariat. And as I said, we're working in 100 countries around the world, which was well beyond what the original founders ever dreamed of. I think their original idea was, let's see if we can get this going in about 30 countries. And today, 15 years later, we're working in nearly 100. So it's been a really quick trajectory. The issue obviously had its moment. As I said, it was a sort of post-Cold War topic that no longer had to be taboo. And it really held resonance then, I think, with where the world was moving. It was a world that was opening up. People wanted to look at new political systems, say, in the former Soviet Union, in Central and Eastern Europe. Latin American democracies were really in a growth phase. And it's also been, you know, a turbulent time in terms of the way the world trade and markets have grown. So there's been challenges along the way, but for sure the issue had its right moment, and the organization was, you know, cast off at a moment when we could make an impact, and we continue to do so.
That's really great. I know you have a website. For people that want to learn more about the organization, what kinds of things can they do?
Well, certainly we'd love to hear their voice. We'd love to know what issues concern them. We're represented in Canada, And it would be fantastic to learn more about the concerns of Canadians as regarding transparency. Actually, the chairwoman of our board, Huguette Labelle, is a Canadian, so we're very proud to be well represented by Canada. There's a lot of things that are happening around the world. It's important that our information about Canada and about other countries is read and distributed, and it's very important that we spread the word about the importance of the fight against corruption. So we'd love to hear people's concerns and also to know more about what they'd like to see done and how they think transparency can help at all levels, local level, state level, regional level.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add in this conversation?
Well, I think I'd like to finish for those who say this is all pie in the sky, that fighting corruption is a really crucial challenge for the world. One needs to only think right now of the financial crisis and of the risks that were taken in markets, the way that lack of regulation and lack of transparency led to a very unsustainable financial system, and the struggles that all our governments are going to have in the coming months and years to build the wall back up again so mm-hmm. that economies can grow and people don't continue to lose jobs and homes and so on. So fighting corruption is not only relevant, but also I'd like to tell the audience that it's doable. There are lots of things that have happened around the world that have already made a difference, we think, because of our work. We have legal advice centers in almost 40 countries where citizens can walk in off the street and
explain
what they're doing and what's happened and where they've been asked for a bribe. We monitor the way political parties make commitments on anti-corruption during an election, and then we go see what they deliver after they're voted into office. We do all kinds of diagnostics and studies to try to get the word out to academia and to the media about the level of corruption in a particular institution. For example, last year we did a very innovative report on the way companies in the oil and gas sector are reporting on transparency issues. So we think that in lots of small ways we're helping to really throw light on corruption, which is the best antiseptic, actually.
Yeah.
And that a lot of things can be done. And what we hope is that these different threads come together and in the long run we actually feel a sense that corruption is abating and we can really make a difference in people's lives for the long run.
Yeah, that's really cool, especially this track record of what the politicians are saying before they get elected and what they do. Do I understand that right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's really neat. Okay, well, I'm glad I asked you that. Anything else you'd like to talk about?
No, I just again like to thank you for the opportunity and hope we've convinced a few people of the importance of the fight against corruption and being committed to the importance of transparency and disclosure in public and private sector.
Okay. This has been Ryan Fletcher of Sustainable Futures with Robin Hodes of Transparency International. So we just got a few more minutes to round up the show, and what I've done is I've taken some old material from the Sustainable SFU Festival. CGSF did a live broadcast from that festival, which was held last September. Now I'm going to take some excerpts from that, and it's just going to introduce you with some sustainable organizations for a few minutes while we round out the show.
Yes, indeed. This is CGSF 90.1 SFU Radio Burnaby, Ideas and Issues. Good afternoon. You're here with Simon Fraser's very own Sasha Hosania, making his radio debut. And I'm joined by my partner in crime, Adam Huggins. Adam, please feel free to interrupt at any time. And I am chatting with the participants of SFU's Sustainability Festival at the Convocation Mall, which started at 10 o'clock this morning and continues until 5 this evening. The festival features live music, dance performances, face painting and more, and I think I saw some mini golf going on as well. You can participate in the free cycle exchange by dropping off used or extra clothing, small appliances, books, stationery. And you can also pick up something else someone else has left. So I have two guests right now. Ladies, please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name's Roxanne Cave, and I manage the 10,000 Villages store on Denman Street. It's a fair trade store, and we have lots of fabulous, sustainable fair trade items.
Hi, I'm Doris, and I'm from United We Can, the bottle depot located in the downtown east side. It's a social enterprise nonprofit, and we employ people who live in the downtown east side.
Okay, I'll start with you, Doris. Could you tell us a bit about your involvement today?
Basically, I work for United We Can now. I used to be a student at SFU, and I was in the Sustainable Community Development Program. And me and a group of students decided to write a business plan for United We Can, and so we approached them, and now we're implementing it. I do pickups for different residences and businesses in the downtown area, and I go out with people who identify themselves as binners, who go out and look for refundable beverage containers and any other reusable items to use and to collect money. And it kind of gives them a little boost in terms of self-confidence as well as their income, because a lot of the times they don't make enough with their welfare checks. And a lot of them have the Bottle Depot is a real place that they can create community on their own and gain independence, because they actually have jobs, and because we employ them, and it's a great place.
And how's your day gone so far today?
It's good. It's a little chilly, but it's going good.
That's Vancouver for you.
Yeah, for sure. And the hill.
And if students were interested, how could they become involved in something like this?
No matter what department you're from, United We Can really tries to... We don't have any volunteers at our organization. Ken Lioche, who started the organization, really tries to make a fit between the student and the organization. So in our case, it was a business plan. In another case, there was a student from Emily Carr, who was an industrial designer, and he designed a cart for a thesis project. And so any idea that you have that fits our organization, he really tries to make it benefit the student as well as the organization and the community. If you have any ideas in terms of a project that would fit, email us UWCBD, as in Bottle Depot, at telus.org. And yeah, we can get back to you and see how it goes.
Great. Yeah. Thank you very much, Doris.
Thanks.
Roxanne?
Well, 10,000 Villages has been, we're the largest and oldest fair trade organization in North America. And we're here today with a small selection of some of the fair trade products that we carry at our various stores. We have three in Vancouver proper. And, like Doris, what we're doing is actually providing fair employment for people from all around the world, small artisan groups, producers. And in some cases, these are people who, they're also collecting pop cans in Kenya, in Vietnam, and then they're using their artistic skills to create interesting items like boxes or earrings from pop cans. That's just sort of an example of the kinds of products that we carry. And then we pay them a fair price, so they're able to support their families, send their kids to school, do all the kinds of things that we often take for granted here in privileged North America. And then by providing them with fair employment, they're able to support themselves with dignity. That's what fair trade is all about. So we have a small selection here today, and we invite students and everybody else, when they need to make a purchase for a gift or something for their place, it's a great place to come and make a purchase that they know can make a difference in people's lives.
Just to be very specific, we all have a relative idea of what fair trade consists of, but making a difference, as opposed to what makes 10,000 Villages a better choice than other retailers?
Because what we're all about is we put people before profit. We are we're owned by a not-for-profit. Our whole reason for being is to ensure that people who are making the product that we sell, that they actually are able to support themselves and their families. So we don't have shareholders. Money isn't going into anybody's pocket. We're just, as long as we're able to pay our overheads, pay our basic expenses, then everything else goes back into ensuring that people all around the world who have skill and ingenuity and talent are being able to support themselves and their families.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's. I think people can really feel good about the purchase that they make through 10,000 Villages, and it's a great place for gifts and things for the home as well.
Okay, thank you to both our guests, Doris and Roxanne.
Thank you.
And
thanks.
Good luck for the rest of the day.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And so there you have it. This is today's episode of Sustainable Futures. I hope you've really enjoyed the experience of listening to this show. You can catch old episodes of Sustainable Futures on the website radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, and all.net. This is the 20th edition, so there's 19 other sustainable adventures to listen to if you are so inclined. So thank you for listening. I am Ryan Fletcher, and I am wishing you a sustainable future.